Okay, here we are again. Thanks for all you guys. Thanks for all you guys for. Is that? Can you hear me okay? Thanks all you guys for sticking with us through the afternoon. Again, I'm Dan and I'm an alcoholic, and this is.
I'm Sheldon and I'm an alcoholic.
In the morning, we looked at the first three steps, we got to this place where we left off at the third step, and with the third step, saying the third step by itself, it's just a prayer. But we also gave it a lot of thought. It says we thought well before taking the step, making sure we were ready, that we could last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. So what that means for me is that if I'm sincere about this, then I realize that I made this commitment, but I don't necessarily know what this is all going to look like yet. I've said the prayer, but personally, I didn't necessarily know what God was going to be in my life or how this was going to work. I know that I hear a lot of people. Some people come into the program with a strong belief in what God is. So I'm just really talking about my own experience, and that was coming into the program the way I came in, not believing at all, just for me to be at this place that I'm open to see what can come from this, was a big deal for me. But I didn't at the third step necessarily know what God was going to be or how that was going to look in my life. But I was willing to abandon myself to the process to find out what can happen from this. And it isn't based in virtue. Right? I'm not looking at this idea of God from a place of virtue. I'm looking at it from a place of desperation. Right? And for me, there seems to be a connection between my level of desperation and how much work I'm willing to put into this. So at any point from now on, if I stop or slow down, chances are I've lost some of that desperation. Right? But initially here, on the bottom of 63, it says, next we launched out on a course of vigorous action. Right? Launching out sounds like what they're talking about is jumping into some kind of action, and it's vigorous action. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision, the third step decision, was a vital and crucial step, could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. So that turns into a great prayer, and I'll let you talk about the prayer, Michelle.
Yes. We say the third step prayer. I usually, what I did in my experience was is I did it on my knees. And now the set-aside prayer is out of my vocabulary. I'm looking at the third step, and that's going to carry me through the rest of the steps up to a certain point. And being that we launch into this, I work in aerospace. I work on the space shuttle and a lot of other launch vehicles. And a launch is extraordinarily quick. Launching and then with vigorously, this is serious. We need to do this now. There's no hesitation here from the third step decision, the third step prayer. We launch vigorously into this fourth step. So the prayer... the third step prayer is my prayer, but there's a prayer here that I'm going to face and be rid of the things that are blocking me from the sunlight of the Spirit. And these are the things that, this is the attitude that I'm going into this fourth step with, because I'm going to utterly abandon, there's really powerful words, utterly abandon myself to God. This is a very powerful moment in the process where I'm giving up all choice. I made a choice that God is either everything or he's nothing. I made a decision, not a choice, to turn my will and life over to the care of this God. And now I'm going to take the action. I'm going to take the action to do that. And I need to stay in conscious contact with God in order for this inventory to be a truth-facing process and a fact-finding process. It's a truth-facing and fact-finding process. So the prayer is very important because I'm blocked. Right, I found that out in page 52, that I'm blocked from the sunlight of the Spirit. That page 52 is dominant in my life, and that I want those things to look a different way. I don't want to have trouble with personal relationships. I don't want to have trouble with misery and depression. I want those things to look different. And on my own, we found out that on my own, I can't do this. So I'm going to turn to God now. I'm going to ask God to help me to be rid of the things that are blocking him from us, because our liquor was but a symptom. So we had to go down. We had to get down to causes and conditions. So this is where I'm going to get down to what wrong with me, right? That question that we were asking, what's wrong with me? So now I'm going to look at the causes and conditions of the things that are blocking me from the sunlight of the Spirit.
Yeah, so the prayer, God, please help me face and be rid of the things in myself that are blocking me from you, other people, and myself. Interesting thing about the idea of being blocked is when I started the inventory process, I didn't really understand being blocked because I hadn't ever experienced any other condition in my life except being blocked, right? And a lot of people who have done a thorough inventory can relate to that. Is after you get to the other side of it and get beyond it, and you're living in 10, 11, and 12, it doesn't take much for you to feel being blocked again, right? Mm-hmm. So the point here is that until I'm willing to do the process, I'm never going to be able to face and be rid of the things that are blocking me, and that I'm not really even aware of, right? So therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. And that's a good validation for why we go through the process again more than once. Because obviously, if a business were to take an inventory of their stock, you wouldn't hear them say, "Well, I've taken an inventory. I don't have to do that ever again," right? Because things change. So it's important to know that the force board to realize that this process, the inventory process, is an incredible spiritual tool, right? And the chances are that it's something that we should be doing for the rest of our lives. The hope is that we're not writing as much of it later on, right?
Right, right. So so we're going to talk about how a business that doesn't take a regular inventory can go broke. So what does that look like? So a guy down the street, he has a shop where he sells purses. And there's another guy, he's just a few miles down, and he sells purses also. So he goes on the shelf, and this one purse is just not selling. And this other guy is attached to all the purses that that aren't selling, and he doesn't want to take them off his shelf. This other guy takes an inventory, he pulls them off the shelf, he throws them in a box, half off. He wants to get rid of the stock that is not working in his store. So that's what we kind of do with inventory. We get rid of the things that aren't useful, and God is going to sort that out, actually, but we'll say we're going to have these things removed.
It says, if the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about value.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's important for me to understand how easy it is for me to fool myself about the value of resentment. If I have a little resentment, I could fool myself thinking that that's okay. It's not a big deal. Right? But then I get another little resentment. But that's okay. It was just a little resentment. Right? And then I get another little resentment. Before you know it, it's like, okay, I think I need to go back through the process again because I've got all these little resentments that are blocking me. Because now I'm starting to feel it. Right? I fool myself about the value of all the time of things. If you were to look at my closet, right, it's full of clothes. Right? If I were to pull off what I actually wear in the closet, right, that's not much of it that I wear.
You could live in it.
I could live in it. It's a big closet.
Yeah.
But the point is that when it comes to resentments, it's going to talk about it in a minute. I think we hit it now.
Yes.
Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else, even alcohol. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. Right? For we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. And it's important to see this. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. When the spiritual malady reoccurs, what happens mentally and physically then, right? From the very beginning, in step one, we've looked at how the unmanageability of my spiritual life can set up the condition conducive for the obsessions to return, and I drink again. Right? And all through the book, it's going to help us identify spiritual separation, because that becomes a matter of life and death for a real alcoholic.
So, Dan was talking about little resentments. Here it's telling me that there's no little resentment. It's an offender. It's a killer. And, fooling myself that, you know, it's just a little resentment. That's what Dan was talking about. And I do that. I do that. That wasn't that big of a deal. And I'm really not that upset about it. But as I'm saying that to myself, I'm reliving that resentment right then and there. And it's a red flag. All of a sudden, I'm reliving it again. Resentment is to re-feel. Resentment is to re-feel something. And I heard someone describe it very well. It's like in football. The guy fumbles the ball, and they keep showing it over and over again. I'm sure he's pretty resentful at that, because he has to relive that fumble every time, every time. And that's what I do with my resentments. They're constantly going on in my head. I'm reliving it, I'm going over it. And but I will fool myself, right, that it isn't that big a deal. And yet, I'm here, and it's telling me that it's an offender. It's worse than alcohol. It's a killer. Why is it a killer? Because the more resentments I have, the more I'm blocked. The more I'm blocked, the less God is in between me and another drink.
So here's the first instruction. It says, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, and principles with whom we were angry. Right. So with that, I just focus on one instruction at a time. I pray, I ask God to show me what names have to be on the list or should be on the list, and I just make a list.
you make it easy. You make it easy on yourself. You don't want to be slammed with all of these instructions all at once.
But you have to be realistic at some point. But not when I work with people, I tell them not to worry about the cause of the resentment yet. Just make a list. Mm-hmm. Pray, make a list. But what sometimes we find is that we don't necessarily find the real resentment to write about with a particular name. Sometimes it ends up being used somewhere else. Right? Just pray, make a list. If you feel it needs to be on the list, we write it down. When I first did my first inventory with my home group was doing it, it was very common for people to have huge lists. I had like 500 names in my first call.
I had 450. We used to have little who has the most. Oh, you should see how many I have. Oh no, I have more than you.
There was people. One guy who asked me to help him, he had 2,000 names in his first call. He wasn't able to finish that. And I was like, I wasn't surprised. I discourage that. I don't necessarily tell them, I don't necessarily tell them what's supposed to be on the list at this point, but we talk about what is a real resentment. And resentment is something that when I think about it, it bothers me. It's that simple, right? It still bothers me. There's fancier ways to describe it, but that seems to be the simplest. When the person comes to mind, I still feel bothered by it.
Go ahead then.
Okay. After that list is done, we start to get more selective. The next instruction is we ask ourselves why we are angry. So we go back to the list, take the first name off the list, write the causes of the resentment. And I letter the causes. A, first cause. B, second cause. C, third cause. At this point, I ask the people I work with to start being realistic. Is there really a resentment here? Because if there isn't really a resentment, it might be better just to skip the name. Right? They pray and what needs to be on the list will come. And also to be careful about obsession. Being obsessive with the list. I work with one guy, he's Asian, and he went through his yearbooks in school, and he listed every name of the people that he thought were prejudiced against Asians. Right? This guy had 900 names or something like that. And I said, take all of those names and list them under people that are prejudiced, people I feel don't like me because I'm Asian. And I group them. Because it's going to look the same anyway as you're writing. Right?
Yeah, it gets really redundant. You're writing each one of those names, and if you look at it, it's just the same thing, just a different name. Right. You start shuffling names, and you start shuffling faces and resentments, and all of a sudden, you're just overwhelmed and inundated with statements like, I'm never going to finish this.
Right.
This is just too much.
Yeah. I think that took almost 100 names off his list doing that. See, when you're working with someone, they don't know how much work is coming. I think some of you people do. You had a question?
Hey, can you give an example of a principle or a principle you look like?
The principle of love. Okay, love's the principle. I resent the principle of love. What's the cause? Every time I fall in love, I get my heart broke. That would be kind of like a principle in that respect. Is that?
I think that one of the things that I've been seeing is people talking about a principles inventory. And what I say is, while you're writing on your principles, if you have any resentments, do you think it's a good idea to write on them too, as far as people?
Right.
And what about institutions while you're at it? Maybe while you're writing on the principles, if there's any institutions you have resentments in, maybe you should write about those too. So to worry about which category they fall in I don't think it's as important as making a list of the things that bother you. But a principle is a tenet or a doctrine. I actually have a whole thing I did on them. I wish I brought it, because I had a lot of examples, but like AA has principles, right? AA has principles, like don't get into a relationship in the first year, right? That's a principle of AA. Where does that come from? I'm not saying it's bad, I'm not saying it's good, I'm just saying it's a principle that you might not like.
Yeah, it's kind of a given principle. There's also other principles that could have been given to you as a child, you know, there's some people that, look, I did a principles like that, you know, I'm never going to be anything in my life. I'll never accomplish anything. And that became a principle that I lived by. I'll never accomplish anything. And that was a principle that was given to me by people as I was growing up. And you can look at things like that, but I wouldn't get too complicated. Like, this is just what I resent, you know. Institutions, marriage, jail system, the army, you know, just all these different institutions.
There's also principles like you hear some people in meetings say, you don't have to worry about this book stuff, just go to meetings, right? There's did you have a question?
If it's okay, generally I've had, for an example of my own that I'm struggling with, people, certain characteristics and behaviors in patterns of people that I've grouped together, like people that are such and such, or people that are don't take responsibility for their behavior, or they're victims, or they're whiny, or they're liars, or they're womanizers, or they're, these. I said principles because I didn't know where to categorize them at, but I have some things grouped together that are characteristics and behaviors of certain people that I resent that behavior with a lot of different people instead of putting all the different people.
Sure, that's a principle that is you have given them, and you resent, like, you don't want to be a liar, right? And lying is a principle that you don't want to live by. You don't want to be a liar. So you expect everybody else in the world not to be a liar. So you, yeah, what I'm saying is that's a very creative.
Well, these things interfere with me.
Right,
I resent
exactly.
Them, they disturb me.
But
so
you're not putting each individual down, you're putting a group of people. Yeah. Yeah.
Not necessarily a principle, because there was a defining, we were trying to define the difference between what I was talking about and certain, and what a principle actually was, and I didn't know where else to categorize them. All I know is that they disturbed me, and I'm bothered by it, and I felt really strongly about putting it on there, and I grouped it together as a characteristic of certain things.
It's more important that if you feel that it bothers you, that you write it down and not worry what the label is. Because you can get caught up in that. You know, there's also principles of religion, right? Rules and ideas that are based on your religious beliefs. There's principles of society, right? Rules of society that we may not like. You know, I don't like that taxes have to be a way of life, or such a big part of my life. I don't like the idea that there's just all kinds of things, like, you know, men that today that whose wives are making more money than they are, right? So the principle that man is supposed to be the provider of the family, right? And there's some women that are doing a much better job at it, but that's, you know, but that's, those are like, those are like just kind of like rules that have come about just from society, you know. Those are, you know, those are, that's what a principle is. A lot of times when I've seen people write principle lists, they sound a lot like fears, right? And there's nothing wrong with that, because if you have fears that bother you, put them on the list.
And bracket it.
But I'm talking about fears in the first column.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm just
talking about fears in the first column. The fact is that inventory is a spiritual tool, and you can learn to apply it to anything that bothers you.
Hell, I resented inventory. You know, right. It was a principle in itself.
Right. Like, why do they have to be so big?
Jesus, what are they doing to me?
But it was out of that experience of seeing all these big inventories that we realized
that is not necessary.
It can be really, it can be detrimental, because you could always write more inventory. So it's more important that I get the main ones down. So there's a point in the book where it talks about we made a list of our grosser handicaps, right? So that's a good argument for why you could just make the list of the worst resentments, the worst things that bother you, right? And some of that stuff you can get back to. What you'll find is when the big ones fall away, so do some of the small ones. Right? They no longer carry as much heat. So,
yeah,
sure. So, then it goes on to say, the next instruction is we ask ourselves why we were angry. Right? So we listed those things. We already did that.
We already did that.
Okay, there's another point I wanted to make. We listed the cause of resentments, why we were angry. I'm angry at this from that person. I'm also angry at this, and I'm angry at that, and I'm angry at that. Before you know it, you're running out of letters, right? Sometimes you have people that like
double AA, BB, CC. I did that
because you have so many reasons.
You don't have
to. so many causes of the resentment for me to be. That I have to write about this particular person. What I find is that the more I write here in the cause, is the more I'm trying to validate to myself and to you my right to be a victim of what you've done to me.
Right, the cause can turn into a whole new resentment. I mean, you can write, well, no, actually you can discount the resentment, and they still harmed you more than they harm, you know, they... You're more angry at them than they are at you, or what am I trying to say? You can write way too much in the cause to where it's just like nothing anymore.
But there's something that happens when you get it all down on paper, right? I let them write first. But I also ask them to try to be specific with the cause, be careful not to write the same thing over and over and over again, right? He hit me, he kicked me, he threw me to the ground, he beat me up. That pretty much covers it.
That's kind of like what I was trying to say, is that, you know, you can just, you know, just write way too much, and it just starts to not sound like a resentment anymore. It sounds like you're a victim of some.
What I also like to tell people to do is to look at their list when they're done with it and pray into it. And read all of the causes of the resentment and ask if they could say what they just wrote in one sentence, right? One or two sentences, right? A lot of times what we'll find is we spend so much energy breaking it all down in an effort to be thorough that we build this mountain of work that may not necessarily be productive or more helpful, right? So, pray into the list and ask if if I could look at these like five things, and maybe I could say it in one sentence, and it means the same thing, right? That accomplishes a couple things. One, it becomes an incredibly powerful spiritual exercise to be able to focus on what's really happening here, right? The next great thing about that, an exercise like that, is it makes the fifth steps that you're listening to a lot smaller.
That's really what we want. I had Joe, my favorite Joe Hawk. I was going to St. Louis, and Joe had worked with this guy over the phone, Bucky. And Bucky was a piece of work. So Joe says, while you're in St. Louis, this guy's in Kentucky, he's going to come to St. Louis and listen to his inventory. I'm a year sober. And I've listened to a couple of inventories, and I said, okay, sure. Well, Bucky comes in with three backpacks full. He had inventory this high. I don't know how he did it. It was a God intervention. We did it in 2 days. But I never want to go through that again. So I'm not giving any. We want to get that. Personally, I don't know how you feel about this, Dan, but personally, I think anything over 30 or 40 is way overdone. I think, and especially if you're working with somebody new, you want to get them, they're in triage, they're dying. You want to get them into inventory, and you don't want to overwhelm them with more than, that's going to take them so long, they're just going to be bored of it. And it happens a lot. You see people pooping out an inventory because they've got these huge inventories and big long causes.
Okay.
No?
We should move forward.
Move forward.
So it says in most cases we found that our self esteem or pocketbooks or ambition or personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore, we were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name for injuries. Was it our self-esteem or security or ambition or personal or sex relations which had been interfered with? So, if you look at this chart here on 65, it says we were usually as definite as this example. If you've used the guide sheets out of the Big Book Awakening, you'll see that this looks a lot like the first two columns filled out. You got the name in the first column. The book actually doesn't refer to the term columns, but that's something a lot of people
use. But it's laid out in columns. I mean, it looks like columns.
But when we write it, we write it
straight across.
Straight down.
Yeah, straight down.
So Mr. Brown, his attention to my wife, told my wife of my mistress, Brown may get my job at the office. So it's generally as just to the point, but then on the guide sheet that we use, it lists the seven areas of self: self-esteem, pride, ambition, security, personal relations, sex relations, and pocketbook. And so when I look at this chart, I don't see three columns finished here. What I see is two columns and a third column waiting to be considered. Right? And we do what is referred to as an extended third column, right? And some people would say, okay, well, it's not in the chart here. It's like, because it's not, you haven't got to that yet, right? We've just done the first, the resentful act, the cause, and listed the seven areas of self waiting for us to consider. Because just below that chart is the next instructions. It says, we went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. And when we were finished, we considered it carefully.
So there comes the extended. Go ahead, son. That's where the extended third column came from. Is that we're going to consider it carefully after we've looked at these first two columns.
Obviously, there's two ways to consider it. One, you can do it mentally, but if you're going to read it to someone in the fifth step, you'd be better off writing it out like we do.
And it's like you're taking notes. In that extended third column, it's like taking a note of what you felt. You're in prayer, you're trusting God to show you the truth, mm-hmm. and you're saying, God, show me the truth about this resentment, and you start writing the third column out, and it's like self-esteem. I'm the best ever person. Because that's what came up in prayer. That's how you felt. And that's just kind of a note for you to, when you fifth step, it's jotted down there. So like Dan says, if you do it mentally, you're going to not have that same experience. So you're writing down your experience you're having with each of the seven areas of self.
Did you have a question?
No, obviously, he started to explain what it looked like to write it, actually write that out. Because there's a lot of people sitting in the room that probably may not know what
that. Yeah, so self-esteem, I'm going to take a look at self-esteem. Is it all right if I go through that? We take a look at self-esteem. Self-esteem is how I see myself in this resentment. Not necessarily in the world. My self-esteem may be high or low in all kinds of different places, but we're only looking at this particular resentment. So self-esteem is how I see myself in this resentment. The resentment is her. The cause, she left me. Self-esteem, I'm the best thing that ever happened to her. So all of a sudden I start to see, I am the best boyfriend she ever had. She should, and then I start to look at how I don't have low self-esteem, because resentment isn't grounded in low self-esteem. Resentment is grounded in high self-esteem. Low self-esteem, I'm cowering in the corner, I'm blubbering, and I'm letting her kick me and kick me and kick me. And I'm just a victim cowering in the corner. But I'm pissed. So now that I'm pissed, it says that we were angry, we were burned up. That isn't low self-esteem. So I take a look at the high self-esteem. I'm the best boyfriend she's ever had. I'm the best boyfriend or man that ever existed. And I start seeing that I'm a god. And then I look at ambition. And my ambition is what I want. What I want out of this, next we look at security. Security is what I need. So what do I need to live? Well, I need her by my side or I'm going to die. So all of a sudden this situation is a life and death situation. It's interfering with my security. But see, that's a skewed way of thinking about security. We all need security. We all need esteem. We can't live without those two things, but I'm skewed in this resentment because it's way off the chart, right? And ambition, what do I want? I want her on her knees begging for forgiveness. That's what I want. That's my ambition. So, you know, I want her to grovel, you know, and come begging to have me come back. And then I look at my pride. Pride. So I look at my pride and I see where I'm prideful, and then I start to look at my personal relationships. Remember, we looked at page 52, and all of these things actually come out of page 52. My esteem, prey to misery and depression. That's my esteem. All these things are natural instincts that we have as human beings. There's nothing wrong with any of these instincts. There's nothing wrong with esteem. There's nothing wrong with ambition or security or any of those things, except when I'm in this anger mode, they're skewed and they're off the chart. So my personal relations is how my friends and family may see me in this resentment. My friends should never see me being left by any woman, especially her. Right? And my family shouldn't have to see me go through this emotional thing with being left by her, something in that realm. I'm just kind of jumping over it. And sex relations. A real man is never left by a woman, especially her. Or even take a look at women, and I look at my skewed vision of how I view women in this also. Some people don't do this. This is what one thing I like to do, is that women are submissive and they take care of their men and never leave them. And then I start seeing I have a really bad way of viewing the opposite sex and the way men are supposed to be and the way men are supposed to be.
Women.
Did I say it? And so I have a very unhealthy belief system, and this belief system has to be destroyed because this is the resentment. This is the festering of the resentment itself. So my pocketbook, what did it cost me? Sometimes people put a dollar value on it. Sometimes I put time value because time is money. I spent a lot of time in this relationship, cost me a lot of money, and nobody messes with my money. Especially her. She owes me. Right? Yeah.
When I write the third column, what I see is that self-esteem and pride are like two sides of a coin. Self-esteem is who I think I am, and pride is how I think you should see who I am, right? I'm here assigning other people a role in my play here. I think this is how you're supposed to see me, right? This is who I am, right? The next two, ambition and security. Ambition, those are also two sides of a coin. Ambition being what I want, security is what I need inside to be okay. Ambition is out here, what I want. Security is inside, what I need to be okay. And what I see is that in order for me to get what I need to be okay inside, I want you to do or react certain ways. I want certain things from you in order to get that. And in order for you to give me that which I want from you, then I've assigned you a role on how you're supposed to interact with me in pride, right? So that will support the role I've assigned myself in self-esteem. The next two, the way I look at them, is also two sides of a coin. Personal relationships is my deep-seated belief systems on how a relationship is supposed to look. Sex relations I look at as seeing how we have a completely different sex inventory. Sex relationship here is what does a real man look like in this interaction? So I have this idea of what a man is supposed to be, and I put that real man into this personal relationship, which I have an idea of how this is supposed to look, right? And there's certain things I need inside to be okay in this relationship for my security. Based on what I need to be okay inside, I want you to be a certain way. So I've assigned you a role in pride, right, and how you're supposed to see me to support the character, the role I've assigned myself here in self-esteem, who I am. Right? So when I look at it like that and start to understand it in that way, it puts a different spin on the third column, in the sense that there was many years I was writing inventory, not necessarily understanding what I was writing, not necessarily understanding how this all connected. When I broke it down like that into different facets of these areas of self, I saw how they connected, how they interconnected, and how they were working in my life. So I think we should move on. Okay. I want to make another point here. It says in support of what I said before, is as far as the progression that we learn in step one, the unmanageability sets up the condition conducive for the obsessions to return, and I drink again. Here on 66, it says, for the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave.
Grave.
Right. Meaning it's deadly. We found that it's fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit, the insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. Right? Spiritual separation sets up the condition conducive for the obsessions to return and we drink again.
and that's why resentment's the killer.
If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. The great definition of brainstorm that I found in an old dictionary is transient fit of insanity.
Really?
Transient fit of insanity. Which is basically, if you think about it, it's throwing tantrums. Right? Transient thing, it comes and goes. Like, all of a sudden, a fit of insanity, and then it goes. Okay? Throwing tantrums. So being grouchy and throwing tantrums are not healthy for alcoholics. Why? Because it's spiritually separating. Okay? It may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. So, that's what resentment is, poison. But it's a different kind of poison. It's the kind of poison where I'm going to take the poison and hope you die.
Right. I'm going to hang on to this resentment and you're going to die.
So the next paragraph talks about turning back to the list, for it held the key to my future. All right. I'm just going to paraphrase this paragraph. The key to my future is being in a place where I can master my resentments. Right? That's a big statement. Right? The key to my future is being in a place where I can master my resentments. Right? But then it goes on to say, but how? It says, this is our course. We realize that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we didn't like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. This paragraph is approached various ways for different people, but my preference is to simply look, take the cause in column two, and ask myself, how, not did I, but how have I done the things in column two to the person in column one and or others? And I found that in all of my resentments, the behavior that I didn't like in others is the same kind of behavior that I find objectionable about myself. Right?
And a lot of psychologists will say that we mirror, and what that means is that I don't like you because you do a certain behavior, and that's because that's the behavior within myself that I'm seeing. So you're mirroring what I do, and that's what this helps us see, that I resent you for the things that I have with inside of myself. We're going to start. There's a prayer here. Do you mind if I talk about it? There's a prayer here right after what Dan read. This is a sick person like ourselves. That's important, I think, because it's kind of left out in this prayer. God help me. God help us show them the same tolerance and pity and patience we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended us, we said to ourselves, this is a sick person, and then up there it said, this is a sick person like myself. So I like to add that here. A sick person like myself. This is a sick man like myself. How can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry. Thy will be done. And this is the prayer that I bring into the fourth column. I don't know if everybody does that, but I call this the fourth column prayer. This is the prayer that's going to help you see the truth about my part in this resentment. I know it doesn't say that in here, but I don't know how else to express it.
So on 67, it goes on to say, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others have done, we resolutely, meaning with determination, look for our own mistakes. Right? It doesn't say we look for or pardon it. It says
our mistakes.
We look for our own mistakes.
Sorry about that. I knew it wasn't in there. I couldn't remember the word mistake, so I said our part.
I'm sorry, I didn't even catch that.
I'm amending. That's actually what we're looking for, is a mistake.
Yeah, where have we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? So the reason it's important to understand that is because sometimes you write inventory, fourth column, on situations that you didn't do anything. Right? Somebody bothers you, and I had this one woman I worked with, and her whole inventory, when we got to the fourth column, we just started to discuss how she responded. She just responded with nothing. She just took it. She was basically a doormat, a big doormat. And big means she was tall. I wasn't. She was real tall. And it's like, it was interesting. What came out of it was that her mistake was that she didn't do anything. She didn't have the power on her own to respond appropriately to what was being done around her. It doesn't mean she should have got resentful and fought back necessarily, but. I think it's a big lesson to learn that sometimes having power doesn't necessarily mean that you don't do anything, right? Sometimes it's about putting a hand in the face and say, that's not okay, right? And some people don't have the power to be able to do what's appropriate. So having power sometimes means that we do some things. But the point here is that her whole inventory was obviously connected to this one type of behavior. So looking at what was her mistake was that on her own power, she didn't have the ability to respond appropriately to situations. Where have we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? You need to speak up a little bit.
Yeah,
so I'm going to just... One of the things that I like to refer to with this in the third column, remember on 62, where it says selfishness and self-centeredness that we think is the root of our trouble? Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. That's the fourth column, right? So the selfish, self-centered false notions is what I saw in the third column, right? And how it's driven by the fourth, right? 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And just like you could read the third column backwards, you could start at the fourth. I have these deep-seated fears, right? These fears are so powerful in my life that it sets up these self-delusions, the lies that I tell myself. From these lies that I tell myself comes a selfish attitude, a selfish thinking, right? And from my selfish attitude comes self-seeking behaviors, right? So that's the fourth column backwards. And I see how those drive this thinking in the third column, right? So when I consider it this way, I first looked at my self-seeking actions. What was I thinking when I was doing those actions? What was the lie I was telling myself, the self-delusions, in that thinking that resulted in that action? And then what was the fear underneath the self-delusions, right? When I do that, I feel pulled down into the fourth column. And I see the connection of all these facets and how they actually drive the thinking in the third column. They give power to the thinking in the third column. Alright, so we're going to do the next part.
Okay. Notice the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties of Mr. Brown, Mr. Jones, and the employer and his wife. So you take your inventory, and as you see the fear that is caused, what would be the fear of his attention to his wife would be, I'm going to take that fear from that, when I bracketed it alongside this resentment, and I'm going to bring it into this fear inventory. And what is that fear? What is that fear? So I'm going to write down my fear. So the fear is that he's going to steal my wife, right? Or something of that sort. He's going to get my job. I'm afraid he's going to get my job. I'm afraid he's going to steal my wife. He's going to, what else do you have here? He may get my job. So there's a lot of fear in there to bring forth into the fear inventory. I think I'm going to have Dan talk about this, how he lays it out. I do it a little bit differently.
When we're laying out the third column, as we're writing each line of the seven areas of self, self-esteem, pride, ambition, security, as we write each one, we look at the fear attached to it. A lot of the times the third column doesn't make a lot of sense until we put the fear next to it, right? And the validation for that, it says, notice the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties, right? So that implies we've already done it, right? We didn't wait till this paragraph or the fourth, the fear inventory to start writing the fear. That it's incorporated into the inventory that we've already been writing.
Right, we pull it from that and bring it here, right?
Right. It says, this short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. Right, those things in the third column are the seven aspects of my life. Right, self-esteem, pride, ambition, security, personal relations, sexual relations, and conflict. Since it was the evil and corroding thread, the fabric of our existence was shot through with it. When I see that I've put fear next to each of the seven areas of self, I can relate to it, seeing that it's that my existence is shot through with it. Right, because on every line of that I wrote in the third column, there's fear attached to it. And it becomes really important to see that, to see how much I'm driven by fear.
It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. Did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Now I'm going to start seeing the mistakes that I have made on how I have actually created this resentment within myself. And any retaliation from the person that I resent is something that I created. So we're going to take responsibility for our actions in this this part of the inventory.
Because sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing.
Why is that?
Well, what is it? Because fear has robbed me of the life that I might have had if I didn't live by fear. If I didn't let fear, if I was able to not let fear steer the direction of my life. But what I've seen through the inventory is that my whole life has been driven by fear.
Mm-hmm.
Right? All through the inventory, I see all of these people that I'm writing on, all these people that I started off thinking, you know, my life is in the toilet because of the result of all these people that did all this stuff to me, and now what I see is really, you know, is that attached to all of these things is fear that's been running my life. And So seeing that in the process here, we come down to a conclusion. We ask ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Right? And I have to see that relying on self-reliance, I couldn't live any other way. Right? Because living on self-reliance is living on an agnostic temperament. Right, living based on my own power, on my own ability. Right, so what I have to see is that I manufacture fear.
Yeah.
Fear doesn't come from out here; it comes from in here.
So, what I got from this was, I look at self-helping self, self-reliance, self-helping self, and what that equates to in my experience is when I'm trying to help myself, self-helping self is like trying to put fire out with gasoline. It just blows up in my face. So then I start seeing how self-reliance has failed me in that moment. It just blows up in my face. I have to be rid of self. You know, this is not a self-help program. It's not, none of this is about me helping self to get better. This is for me to get rid of self and have a conscious contact with God, who is now going to run my life. So this was very powerful for me in the peer inventory. And I think this was more powerful than the resentment, but the resentment inventory got me to this.
Right.
So I want to
leave
some time for this, but I want to close up. On 68 it says, perhaps there's a better way. We think so. We're now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. It says, we are in the world to play the role he assigns.
And that's what I was talking about.
What I've seen all through the inventory is how I've been in the world assigning roles to you, and how you're supposed to act, how you're supposed to treat me, who I'm supposed to be, what things are supposed to look like, right? I've been in the world playing God, assigning roles to everything around me, which is interesting, because remember, it doesn't change chapters from the third step to the fourth step, right? It goes from the actor trying to run the whole show to this, and now it says we're in the world to play the role that God assigns, right? So I just kind of want to summarize it with this prayer. That's one of my favorite prayers. It says, is that we ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. That's one of the prayers that I use the most.
Not what he would have us do. Sometimes that gets skewed, right?
Mm-hmm.
What he would have us be. So this has saved my life, this prayer, many times.
Mm-hmm.
I incorporate this actually with my 10th step. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, we don't want to have time for sex, so.
Oh, yes.
So do you want to talk about it?
Oh, yeah.
Kind of
now about sex. Many of us need an overhauling here.
Just talk about it.
Yeah, so the sex inventory is to look at my sex relations. And I've always looked at sex relations as intimate relationships. It's not all about fornication. It's also about intimate relationships I've had with the opposite sex. So I've taken, and I'm going to make a list just like I did with my inventory of the people I resent. I'm going to write this down in prayer like I've done all the way up to this point, and this list is going to become my sex inventory. And then I start to I put that in a column, and I start to look the same thing I'm looking at in resentment. Where was I selfish? Where was I dishonest? We reviewed our own conduct. Conduct is behavior. It's my behavior in this relationship. So I look at my conduct over the years past. Where had I been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom did I hurt? Now this has always been, what does this mean? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Unjustifiably. I may have aroused suspicion maybe
but maybe it wasn't unjustified. But I think all of this is unjustified in retrospect, that any time that I have caused a person in an intimate relationship to be jealous, like trying to flirt with somebody else while I'm in a marriage, right, and I'm flirting with somebody else, I'm arousing suspicion just to get a reaction out of her. And I'm trying to ruffle her feathers, let's say. And so that's my conduct. That's my sexual conduct. Some people will say it's about sexual performance, my conduct sexually. I think that can come into play here, but I think it's more about the intimacy that I have in a relationship so that I can get rid of the selfishness and dishonesty and be more upright. And it says, what could I do and what could I have done instead, right? So what could I have done instead? Well, some people say never gotten in the relationship, and that's just a cop-out. What could I have done instead? I could have trusted God. I could have been more forthright. Maybe I could have told her that I really didn't love her and I was just in the relationship for convenience, right? So there's a lot of things that I could have done instead, and that comes out with prayer. And when I'm sitting in prayer, I find that these answers come to me rather than me trying to figure that out. I hope that makes sense.
It's important to be real contemplative when looking at question 9 and really considering what should I have done instead, because what this part of the inventory is followed by is what we refer to as the sex ideal, where we take question 9 and turn it into a prayer, because obviously what I should have done instead I was not capable of. For whatever reason, I was not capable of being the person that I'm considering now. So what should I have done instead? I take all question 9s, turn it into a prayer. In the future, God, in the future, please help me with that. And this is not a prayer for God to give me a relationship. This is a prayer for God to make me who I believe I need to be in a relationship.
Right, right.
Because one of the things that's consistent through all of these pages of sex inventory, one thing is consistent in all of these failed relationships is I was in it. Right? And that I was behaving a certain way. Right? And this, the hope here is that God can move me beyond who I've been in past relationships.
So yeah, the great thing, I always thought it was 5'2", eyes of blue, and that was my sex ideal, right? So what happened was is I had a spiritual awakening because of all of the other columns and looking at the what I should have done instead. All of a sudden, I start seeing that I have to become what I want. If I want somebody to be loving, considerate, understanding, I have to become loving, considerate, and understanding. The sex ideal almost turned into what they should be. And when I did that, I realized that I can't have what they should be without becoming that. So all of a sudden it started to internalize into me that I need to become, and God is going to make that happen. I can't make that happen on my own. That God is going to have me become what I've always wanted out of a relationship, because basically water seeks its own level.
So
go.
We're still trying to stick to a time frame here so that each session fits onto a CD. So we're going to stop here and take a 10-minute break for you guys to stand up and stretch, because the brain can only grasp what the behind can tolerate. So we're going to get up and stretch a little bit, and we'll come back here in 10 minutes.
Yeah. Or stop it.
Stop?
Yeah.
Yeah, make a new file?
Yes.